well, clumsy, inaccurate, not what I meant, nor what I meant to say. We understood one another better before ever I opened my mouth. Chapter 6. Mr. Florey, the surgeon, was a bachelor. He had a large house high up by Santa Maria's, and with the broad, easy conscience of an unmarried man, he invited Dr. Maturin to stay whenever the Sophie should come in for stores or repairs, putting a room at his disposal for his baggage and his collections, a room that already housed the hortus siccus that Mr. Cleghorn, surgeon major to the garrison for close on 30 years, had gathered in countless dusty volumes. It was an enchanting house for meditation, backing on to the very top of Mahon's Cliff, and overhanging the Merchant's Quay at a dizzy height, so high that the noise and business of the harbour was impersonal, no more than an accompaniment to thought. Stephen's room was at the back, on this cool northern side looking over the water, and he sat there just inside the open window, with his feet in a basin of water, writing his diary while the swifts, common, pallid and alpine, raced shrieking through the torrid, quivering air between him and the Sophie, a toy-like object far down on the other side of the harbour, tied up to the victualling wharf. "So James Dillon is a Catholic," he wrote in his minute and secret shorthand. "He used not to be. That is to say, he was not a Catholic in the sense that it would have made any marked difference to his behaviour, or have rendered the taking of an oath intolerably painful. He was not in any way a religious man. Has there been some conversion, some Loyolan change? I hope not. How many crypto-Catholics are there in the service? I should like to ask him, but that would be indiscreet. I remember Colonel Despard's telling me that in England, Bishop Challoner gave a dozen dispensations a year for the occasional taking of the sacrament according to the Anglican rite. Colonel T. of the Gordon Riots was a Catholic. Did Despard's remark refer only to the army? I never thought to ask him at the time. Query. Is this the cause for James Dillon's agitated state of mind? Yes, I think so. Some strong pressure is certainly at work. What is more, it appears to me that this is a critical time for him, a lesser climacteric, a time that will settle him in that particular course he will never leave again but will persevere in for the rest of his life. It has often seemed to me that towards this period, in which we all three lie, more or less, men strike out their permanent characters, or have those characters struck into them. Merriment, roaring high spirits before this, then some chance concatenation, or some hidden predilection, or rather inherent bias, working through, and the man is in the road he cannot leave but must go on, making it deeper and deeper, a groove or channel, until he is lost in his mere character, persona, no longer human, but an accretion of qualities belonging to this character. James Dillon was a delightful being. Now he's closing in. It is odd, will I say heartbreaking, how cheerfulness goes, gaiety of mind, natural free springing joy. Authority is its great enemy, the assumption of authority. I know few men over 50 that seem to me entirely human, virtually none who has long exercised authority. The senior post-captains here, Admiral Warne, shrivelled men, Shrivelled in essence, not, alas, in belly. Pomp, an unwholesome diet, a cause of choler, a pleasure paid too late and at too high a price, like lying with a peppered paramour. Yet Lord Nelson, by Jack Aubrey's account, is as direct and unaffected and amiable a man as could be wished. So, indeed, in most ways, is J.A. himself, though a certain careless arrogancy of power appears at times. His cheerfulness, at all events, is with him still. How long will it last? What woman, political cause, disappointment, wound, disease, untoward child, defeat? What strange, surprising accident will take it all away? But I am concerned for James Dillon. He is as mercurial as ever he was, more so. Only now it is all 10 octaves lower down and in a darker key. And sometimes I'm afraid, in a black humour, he will do himself a mischief. I would give so much to bring him cordially friends with Jack Aubrey. They are so alike in so many ways. And James is made for friendship. When he sees that he is mistaken about J.A.'s conduct, surely he'll come round. But will he ever find this out? Or is J.A. to be the focus of his discontent? If so, there is little hope. For the discontent, the inner contest, must at times be very severe in a man so humourless on occasion, and so very exigent upon the point of honour. He is obliged to reconcile the irreconcilable more often than most men, and he is less qualified to do so. And whatever he may say, he knows as well as I do that he's in danger of a horrible confrontation. Suppose it had been he who took Wolfe Tone in Lough Swilly. What if Emmet persuades the French to invade again? And what if Bonaparte makes friends with the Pope? It is not impossible. But on the other hand, J.D. is a mercurial creature, and if once on the upward rise he comes to love J.A. as he should, he will not change. Never was a more loyal affection. I would give a great deal to bring them friends. He sighed and put down his pen. He put it down upon the cover of a jar, in which there lay one of the finest asps he had ever seen. Thick, venomous, snub-nosed, coiled down in spirits of wine, with its slit-pupilled eye looking at him through the glass. This asp was one of the fruits of the days they spent in Mahon before the Sophie came in, a third prize at her tail, a fair-sized Spanish tartan. And next to the asp lay two visible results of the Sophie's activity, a watch and a telescope. The watch pointed at 20 minutes to the hour, so he picked up the telescope and focused it upon the sloop. Jack was still aboard, conspicuous in his best uniform, fussing amidships with Dillon and the boatswain over some point of the upper rigging. They were all pointing upwards, and inclining their persons from side to side in ludicrous unison. Leaning forward against the rail of the little balcony, he trained his glass along the quay towards the head of the harbour. Almost at once he saw the familiar scarlet face of George Pierce, ordinary seaman, thrown back skywards in an ecstasy of mirth. There was a little group of his shipmates with him, along by the huddle of one-storied wine shops that stretched out towards the tanneries, and they were passing their time at playing ducks and drakes on the still water. These men belonged to the two prize crews, and they'd been allowed to stay ashore, whereas the other Sophies were still aboard. Both had shared in the first distribution of prize money, however, and looking with closer attention at the silvery gleam of the skipping missiles and at the frenzied diving of the little naked boys out in the noisome shallows, Stephen saw that they were getting rid of their wealth in the most compendious manner known to man. Now a boat was putting off from the Sophie, and in his glass he saw the coxswain nursing Jack's fiddle case with stiff, conscious dignity. He leant back, took one foot out of the water, tepid now, and gazed at it for a while, musing upon the comparative anatomy of the lower members in the higher mammals, in horses, in apes, in the pongo of the African travellers, or Monsieur de Buffon's Jocko, sportive and gregarious in youth, sullen, morose, and withdrawn in age. Which was the true state of the pongo? Who am I? He thought, to affirm that the gay young ape is not merely the chrysalis, as it were the pupa, of the grim old solitary. That the second state is not the natural inevitable culmination. The pongo's true condition, alas. I was contemplating on the pongo, he said aloud as the door opened and Jack walked in with a look of eager expectation carrying a roll of music. I'm sure you were, cried Jack. A damn creditable thing to be contemplating on, too. Now, be a good fellow and take your other foot out of that basin. Why on earth did you put it in? And pull on your stockings, I beg. We have not a moment to lose. No, not blue stockings. We're going on to Mrs. Hart's party. To her rout. Must I put on silk stockings? Certainly you must put on silk stockings. And do show a leg, my dear chap. We shall be late without you spread a little more canvas. You're always in such a hurry, said Stephen peevishly, groping among his possessions. A Montpellier snake glided out with a dry, rustling sound and traversed the room in a series of extraordinarily elegant curves, its head held up some 18 inches above the ground. Oh, oh, oh! Cried Jack, leaping onto a chair. A snake! Will these do? Asked Stephen. They have a hole in them. Is it poisonous? Extremely so. I dare say it'll attack you directly. I have very little doubt of it. Was I to put the silk stockings over my worsted stockings, so the hole wouldn't show? But then I should stifle with heat. Do not you find it uncommonly hot? It must be 2 fathoms long. Tell me, is it really poisonous? On your oath, now. If you thrust your hand down its throat as far as its back teeth, you may meet a little venom, but not otherwise. Malpolomus pesulanus is a very innocent serpent. I think of carrying 12 aboard for the rats. Oh, if only I had more time, and if it were not for this foolish, illiberal persecution of reptiles. What a pitiful figure you do cut upon that chair, to be sure. Barney, Barney, Buck or Doe has kept me out of Channel Row, he sang to the serpent. And deaf as an adder though it was, it looked happily into his face while he carried it away. Their first visit was to Mr. Brown's of the dockyard, where, after greetings, introductions, and congratulations upon Jack's good fortune, they played the Mozart B-flat quartet, hunting it along with great industry and goodwill, Miss playing a sweet-toned, though weak, viola. They had never played all together before, had never rehearsed this particular work, and the resulting sound was ragged in the extreme, but they took immense pleasure there in the heart of it, and their audience, Mrs. Brown and a white cat, sat mildly knitting, perfectly satisfied with the performance. Jack was in tearing high spirits, but his great respect for music kept him in order throughout the quartet. It was during the collation that followed, a pair of fowls, a glazed tongue, syllabub, flummery, and maids of honour, that he began to break out. Being thirsty, he drank off 2 or 3 glasses of sillery without noticing them, and presently his face grew redder and even more cheerful, his voice more decidedly masculine and his laughter more frequent. He gave them a highly coloured account of Stephen's having sawn the gunner's head off and fixed it on again, better than before. And from time to time his bright blue eye wandered towards Mrs. Bosom, which the fashion of that year, magnified by the distance from Paris, had covered with no more than a very, very little piece of gauze. Stephen emerged from his reverie to see Mrs. Brown looking grave, Miss looking demurely down at her plate, and Mr. Brown who had also drunk a good deal, starting on a story that could not possibly come to good. Mrs. Brown made great allowances for officers who had been long at sea, particularly those who had come in from a successful cruise and were disposed to be merry, but she made less for her husband, and she knew this story of old as well as this somewhat glassy look. "Come, my dear," she said to her daughter, "I think we will leave the gentleman now." Molly Hart's rout was a big, miscellaneous affair, with nearly all the officers, ecclesiastics, civilians, merchants, and Minorcan notables, so many of them that she had a great awning spread over Senor Martinez's patio to hold all her guests, while the military band from Fort St. Philip played to them from what was ordinarily the commandant's office. "Allow me to name my friend, my particular friend and surgeon, Dr. Maturin," said Jack, leading Stephen up to their hostess. "Mrs. Hart."
"Your servant, ma'am," said Stephen, making a leg.
"I'm very happy to see you here, sir," said Mrs. Hart, instantly prepared to dislike him very much indeed.
"Dr. Maturin, Captain Hart," went on Jack.
"Happy,"
said Captain Hart, disliking him already, but for an entirely opposite reason, looking over Stephen's head and holding out two fingers only a little way in front of his sagging belly. Stephen looked deliberately at them, left them dangling there, and silently moved his head in a bow whose civil insolence so exactly matched his welcome that Molly Hart said to herself, "I shall like that man." They went on to leave room for others, for the tide was flowing fast. The sea officers all appeared within seconds of the appointed time.
"Here's lucky Jack Aubrey," cried Bennett of the Aurora. "Upon my word, you young fellows do pretty well for yourselves. I could hardly get into Mahon for the number of your captures. I wish you joy of them, of course, but you must leave something for us old codgers to retire upon, eh? Eh?"
"Why, sir," said Jack, laughing and going redder still, "it's only beginner's luck. It'll soon be out, I'm sure, and then we shall be sucking our thumbs again."
There were half a dozen sea officers round him, contemporaries and seniors. They all congratulated him, some sadly, some a little enviously, but all with that direct goodwill Stephen had noticed so often in the Navy. And as they drifted off in a body towards a table with three enormous punch-bowls and a regiment of glasses upon it, Jack told them, in an uninhibited wealth of sea jargon, exactly how each chase had behaved. They listened silently with keen attention, nodding their heads at certain points and partially closing their eyes, and Stephen observed to himself that at some levels complete communication between men was possible. After this, both he and his attention wandered. Holding a glass of arak punch, he took up his stand next to an orange tree, and he stood looking quite happy, gazing now at the uniforms on the one hand, and now through the orange tree on the other, where there were sofas and low chairs, with women sitting in them, hoping that men would bring them ices and sorbets, and hoping, as far as the sailors on his left were concerned, in vain. They sighed patiently, and hoped that their husbands, brothers, fathers, lovers would not get too drunk, and above all that none of them would grow quarrelsome. Time passed. An eddy in the party's slow rotatory current brought Jack's group nearer the orange tree, and Stephen heard him say, "There's a hellish great sea running tonight." "It's all very well, Aubrey," said a post-captain almost immediately afterward, "but your Sophies used to be a quiet, decent set of men ashore, and now they have two pennies to rub together, they kick up bobs a dying like, well, I don't know, like a set of mad baboons. They beat the crew of my cousin Oak's barge cruelly upon the absurd pretense of having a physician aboard, and so having the right to tie up a head of a barge belonging to a ship of the line which carries no more than a surgeon. A very absurd pretense.
Their 2 pennies have sent them out of their wits.
I'm sorry Captain Oak's men were beat, sir, said Jack, with a decent look of concern, but the fact is true. We do have a physician aboard, an amazing hand with a saw or a clister.
Jack gazed about him in a very benevolent fashion. He was with me not a pint or so ago. Opened our gunner's skull, roused out his brains, set them to rights, stuffed them back in again. I couldn't bear to look, I assure you, gentlemen. Bade the armourer take a crown piece, hammer it out thin into a little dome, do you see, or basin, and so clapped it on, screwed it down, and sewed up his scalp as neatly as a sailmaker. Now that's what I call a real physic, none of your damn pills and delay. Why, there he is. They greeted him kindly, urged him to drink a glass of punch, another glass of punch. They had all taken a great deal. It was quite wholesome. Excellent punch, the very thing for so hot a day. The talk flowed on, with only Stephen and a Captain Nevin remaining a little silent. Stephen noticed a pondering, absorbed look in Captain Nevin's eye, a look very familiar to him, and he was not surprised to be led away behind the orange tree to be told, in a low, confidential, fluent, earnest voice, of Captain Nevin's difficulty in digesting even the simplest dishes. Captain Nevin's dyspepsy had puzzled the faculty for years, but he was sure it would yield to Stephen's superior powers. He had better give Dr. Maturin all the details he could remember, for it was a very singular, interesting case, as Sir John Abel had told him. Stephen knew Sir John. But, to be quite frank, lowering his voice and glancing furtively round, he had to admit there were certain difficulties in evacuation, too. His voice ran on low and urgent, and Stephen stood with his hands behind his back, his head bowed, his face gravely inclined in a listening attitude. He was not, indeed, inattentive, but his attention was not so wholly taken up that he didn't hear Jack cry, "Oh, yes, yes, the rest of them are certainly coming ashore. They're lining the rail in their shore-going rig with money in their pockets, their eyes staring out of their heads and their pricks a yard long." He could scarcely have avoided hearing it, for Jack had a fine carrying voice, and his remark happened to drop into one of those curious silences that occur even in very numerous assemblies. Stephen regretted the remark. He regretted its effect upon the ladies the other side of the orange tree, who were standing up and mincing away with many an indignant glance. But how much more did he regret Jack's crimson face, the look of maniac glee in his blazing eyes, and his triumphant, "You needn't hurry, ladies, they won't be allowed off the sloop till the evening gun." A determined upsurge of talk drowned any possibility of further observations of this kind, and Captain Nevin was settling down to his colon again when Stephen felt a hand on his arm, and there was Mrs. Hart, smiling at Captain Nevin in such a manner that he backed and lost himself behind the punch bowls. "Dr. Maturin, please take your friend away," said Molly Hart in a low, urgent tone. "Tell him his ship's on fire. Tell him anything. Only get him away. He will do himself such damage." Stephen nodded. He lowered his head and walked directly into the group, took Jack by the elbow and said, "Come, come, come," in an odd, imperative half-whisper, bowing to those whose conversation he had interrupted. "There is not a moment to be lost."
"The sooner we're at sea, the better," muttered Jack Aubrey, looking anxiously into the dim light over against Mahon Quay. Was the boat his own launch with the remaining Liberty men? Or was it a messenger from the angry, righteous commandant's office bringing orders that would break off the Sophie's cruise? He was still a little shattered from his night's excess,
But the steadier part of his mind assured him from time to time that he had done himself no good, that disciplinary action could be taken against him without any man thinking it unjust or oppressive, and that he was exceedingly averse to any immediate meeting with Captain Hart. What air was moving came from the westward, an unusual wind, and one that brought all the foul reek of the tanneries drifting wetly across. But it would serve to help the Sophie down the long harbour and out to sea. Out to sea, where he could not be betrayed by his own tongue, where Stephen could not get himself into bad odour with authority, and where that infernal child Babington did not have to be rescued from aged women of the town, and where James Dillon could not fight a duel. He had only heard a rumour of it, but it was one of those deadly little after-supper garrison affairs that might have cost him his lieutenant. As valuable an officer as he'd ever sailed with, for all his starchiness and unpredictability. The boat reappeared under the stern of the Aurora. It was the launch, and it was filled with Liberty men. There were still one or two merry souls among them, but on the whole the Sophies who could walk were quite unlike those who had gone ashore. They had no money left, for one thing, and they were grey, drooping, and mumchance for another. Those who could not walk were laid in a row with the bodies recovered earlier, and Jack said, "How's the tally, Mr. Ricketts?" "All aboard, sir," said the midshipman wearily. "Except for Jessop, cook's mate, who broke his leg falling down Pigtail Stairs, and Sennett, Richards, and Chambers of the foretop, who went off to Georgetown with some soldiers." "Sergeant Quinn?" But there was no answer to be had from Sergeant Quinn. He could and did remain upright, bolt upright. But his only reply was, "Yes, sir," and a salute to everything that was proposed to him. "All but three of the Marines are aboard, sir," said James privately. "Thank you, Mr. Dillon," said Jack, looking over towards the town again. A few pale lights were moving against the darkness of the cliff. "Then I think we shall make sail." "Without waiting for the rest of the water, sir." "What does it amount to? 2 tons, I believe." "Yes, we'll take that up another time, together with our stragglers. Now, Mr. Watt, all hands to unmoor, and let it be done silently, if you please." He had said this partly because of a cruel, darting agony in his head that made the prospect of roaring and bellowing wonderfully disagreeable, and partly because he wished the Sophie's departure to excite no attention whatsoever. Fortunately, she was moored with simple warps fore and aft, so there would be no slow weighing of anchors, no stamp and go at the capstan, no acid shrieking of the fiddle. In any case, the comparatively sober members of the crew were too jaded for anything but a sour, mute, expeditious casting off. No jolly tars, no hearts of oak, no Britons never-never in this grey stench of a crapulous dawn. Fortunately, too, he had seen to the repairs, stores, and victualling, apart from that cursed last voyage of water, before he or anyone else had set foot on shore, and rarely had he appreciated the reward of virtue more than when the Sophie's jib filled, and her head came round, pointing eastward to the sea, a wooded, watered, well-found vessel, beginning her journey back to independence. An hour later, they were in the Narrows, with the town and its evil smell sunk in the haze behind them, and the brilliant open water out in front. The Sophie's bowsprit was pointing almost exactly at the white blaze on the horizon that showed the coming of the sun, and the breeze was turning northerly, freshening as it veered. Some of the knight's corpses were in lumpish motion. Presently a hose-pipe would be turned onto them. The deck would return to its rightful condition, and the sloop's daily round would begin again. An air of surly virtue hung over the Sophie as she made her tedious, frustrating way south and west towards her cruising ground through calms, uncertain breezes, and headwinds, winds that grew so perverse once they'd made their offing that the little air island beyond the eastern point of Minorca hung obstinately on the northern horizon, sometimes larger, sometimes smaller, but always there. Thursday, and all hands were piped to witness punishment. The two watches stood on either side of the main deck, with the cutter and the launch towing behind to make more room. The marines were lined up with their usual precision from number 3 gun aft, and the little quarter-deck was crowded with the officers. "Mr. Ricketts, where is your dock?" said James Dillon sharply.
"Forgot it, sir. Beg pardon, sir,"
whispered the midshipman. "Put it on at once, and don't you presume to come on deck improperly dressed." Young Ricketts cast a guilty look at his captain as he darted below, and he read nothing but confirmation on Jack's frowning visage. Indeed, Jack's views were identical with Dillon's. These wretched men were going to be flogged, and it was their right to have it done with due ceremony. All hands gravely present, the officers with their gold-laced hats and swords, the drummer there to beat a roll. Henry Andrews, the ship's corporal, brought up his charges one by one. John Harden, Joseph Bussell, Thomas Cross, Timothy Bryant, Isaac Isaacs, Peter Edwards, and John Sorrell, all accused of drunkenness. No one had anything to say for them. Not one had anything to say for himself. "A dozen apiece," said Jack, "and if there were any justice on earth, you would have 2 dozen, Cross. A responsible fellow like you, a gunner's mate, for shame." It was the Sophie's custom to flog at the capstan, not at a grating. The men came gloomily forward, slowly stripped off their shirts, and adapted themselves to the squat cylinder, and the boatswain's mates, John Bell and John Morgan, tied their wrists on the far side, more for the form than anything else. Then John Bell stood clear, swinging his cat easily in his right hand, with his eye on Jack. Jack nodded and said, "Carry on." "One," said the boatswain solemnly, as the 9 knotted cords sighed through the air and clapped against the seaman's tense, bare back. "Two, three, four." So it went on. And once again Jack's cold, accustomed eye noticed how cleverly the boatswain's mate set the knotted ends lashing against the capstan itself, yet without giving any appearance of favouring his shipmate. "It's very well," he reflected, "but either they're getting into the spirit room, or some son of a bitch has brought a store of liquor aboard. If I could find him, I should have a proper grating rigged, and there'd be none of this hocus-pocus. This amount of drunkenness was more than was right. 7 in one day. It was nothing to do with the men's lurid joys ashore, for that was all over, no more than a memory. And as for the paralytic state of the seamen awash in the scuppers as the sloop stood out, that was forgotten too, put down to the easy ways of port, to relaxed harbour discipline, and never held against them. This was something else. Only yesterday he'd hesitated about exercising the guns after dinner, because of the number of men he suspected of having had too much. It was so easy for a tipsy fool to get his foot under a recoiling carriage or his face in front of a muzzle. And in the end, he'd had them merely run in and out without firing. Different ships had different traditions about calling out. The old Sophies kept mum, but Edwards, one of the new men, had been drafted from the King's Fisher, where they did not. And he uttered a great howling, "Oh!" at the first stroke, which so disturbed the young boatswain's mate that the next two or three wavered uncertainly in the air.
"Come now, John Bell," said the boatswain reproachfully, not from any sort of malignance towards Edwards, whom he regarded with the placid impartiality of a butcher weighing up a lamb, but because a job of work had to be done proper, and the rest of the flogging did at least give Edwards some excuse for his shattering crescendo. Shattering, that is to say, to poor John Sorrell, a meagre little quota man from Exeter, who had never been beaten before, and who now added the crime of incontinence to that of drunkenness. But he was flogged, for all that, in great squalor, weeping and roaring most pitifully, as the flustered Bell laid into him hard and fast to get it over quickly. How utterly barbarous this would seem to a spectator that was not habituated to it, reflected Stephen, and how little it matters to those that are. Though that child does appear concerned. Babington was indeed looking a little pale and anxious as the unseemly business came to an end, with the moaning Sorrell handed over to his shamefaced messmates and hurried away. But how transient was this young gentleman's pallor and anxiety! Not 10 minutes after the swabber had removed all traces of the scene, Babington was flying about the upper rigging in pursuit of rickets, with the clerk toiling with laborious, careful delight a great way behind. "Who is that skylarking?" asked Jack, seeing vague forms through the thin canvas of the main royal. "The boys?"
"The young gentleman, Your Honour," said the quartermaster.
"That reminds me," said Jack, "I want to see them." Not long after this, the pallor and anxiety were back again, and with good reason. The midshipman was supposed to take noon observations to work out the vessel's position, which they were to write on a piece of paper. These pieces of paper were called the Young Gentleman's Workings, and they were delivered to the captain by the marine sentry with the words,
"The Young Gentleman's Workings, sir."
To which Captain Allen, an indolent, easy-going man, had been accustomed to reply, "The young gentleman's workings," and toss them out of the window. Hitherto Jack had been too busy working up his crew to pay much attention to the education of his midshipmen, but he'd looked at yesterday's slips, and they, with a very suspicious unanimity, had shown the Sophie in 39°21' north, which was fair enough, but also in a longitude that she could only have reached by cleaving the mountain range behind Valencia to a depth of 37 miles. "What do you mean by sending me this nonsense?" he asked them. It was not really an answerable question, nor were many of the others that he propounded, and they did not in fact attempt to answer them, but they agreed that they were not there to amuse themselves, nor for their manly beauty, but rather to learn their professions, that their journals, which they fetched, were neither accurate, full, nor up-to-date, and that the ship's cat would have written them better, that they would for the future pay the greatest attention to Mr. Marshall's observation and reckoning, that they would prick the chart daily with him, and that no man was fit to pass for a lieutenant, let alone bear any command. "May God forgive me," said Jack, in an internal aside, "who could not instantly tell the position of his ship to within a minute, nay, to within 30 seconds. Furthermore, they would show up their journals every Sunday cleanly and legibly written. You can write decently, I suppose. Otherwise you must go to school to the clerk." They hoped so, they were sure. They should do their best.
but he didn't seem convinced and desired them to sit down on that locker, take those pens and these sheets of paper to pass him yonder book, which would answer admirably for them to be read to out of from. This was how it came about that Stephen, pausing in the quietness of his sick bay to reflect upon the case of the patient whose pulse beat weak and thin beneath his fingers, heard Jack's voice, unnaturally slow, grave, and terrible, come wafting down the windsail that brought fresh air below. The quarter-deck of a man of war may justly be considered as a national school for the instruction of a numerous portion of our youth. There it is that they acquire a habit of discipline and become instructed in all the interesting minutiae of the service. Punctuality, cleanliness, diligence, and dispatch are regularly inculcated, and such a habit of sobriety and even of self-denial acquired that cannot fail to prove highly useful. By learning to obey, they are also taught how to command. Well, 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 said Stephen to himself, and then turned his mind entirely back to the poor, wasted, hare-lipped creature in the hammock beside him, a recent landman belonging to the starboard watch. How old may you be, Cheslin?
Oh, I can't tell you, sir, said Cheslin with a ghost of impatience in his apathy. I reckon I might be about 30, like.
A long pause.
I was 15 when my old father died, and I could count the harvest back if I put my mind to it, but I can't put my mind to it, sir.
No, listen, Cheslin. You will grow very ill if you do not eat. I'll order you some soup, and you must get it down.
Thank you, sir, I'm sure, but there's no relish to my meat, and I doubt they would let me have it any gait.
Why did you tell them your calling?
Cheslin made no reply for a while, but stared dully.
I dare say I was drunk. 'Tis mortal strong, that grog of theirn. But I never thought they would be so adread. Though, to be sure, the folk over the Carver and the country beyond, they don't quite like to name it either.
At this moment, hands were piped to dinner, and the berth deck, the long space behind the canvas screen that Stephen had had set up to protect the sick bay a little, was filled with a tumult of hungry men. An orderly tumult, however. Each mess of eight men darted to its particular place. Hanging tables appeared, dropping instantly from the beams. Wooden kids filled with salt pork, another proof that it was Thursday, and peas came from the galley. And the grog, which Mr. Pullings had just mixed at the scuttlebutt by the mainmast, was carried religiously below, everyone skipping out of its way lest a drop should fall. A lane instantly formed in front of Stephen, and he passed through with smiling faces and kind looks on either side of him. He noticed some of the men whose backs he'd oiled earlier that morning looking remarkably cheerful, particularly Edwards, for he, being black, had a smile that flashed far whiter in the gloom. Attentive hands tweaked a bench out of his way, and a ship's boy was slewed violently round on his axis and desired not to turn his back on the doctor where were his fucking manners. Kind creatures. Such good-natured faces. But they were killing Cheslin.
I have a curious case in the sick bay, he said to James, as they sat digesting Figgy Dowdy with the help of a glass of port. He is dying of inanition.
Or will, unless I can stir his torpor.
What is his name?
Cheslin, he has a hare lip.
I know him, a waster.
Starboard watch, no good to man or beast.
Ah? Yet he's been a singular service to men and women in his time.
In what way?
He was a sin-eater.
Christ!
You've spilt your port.
Will you tell me about him?
Asked James, mopping at the stream of wine. Why, it was much the same as with us. When a man died, Cheslin would be sent for. There would be a piece of bread on the dead man's breast. He would eat it, taking the sins upon himself. Then they would push a silver piece into his hand and thrust him out of the house, spitting on him and throwing stones as he ran away.
I thought it was only a tale nowadays, said James.
No, no, it's common enough under the silence. But it seems that the seamen look upon it in a more awful light than other people. He let it out, and they all turned against him immediately. His mess expelled him. The others will not speak to him, nor allow him to eat or sleep anywhere near them. There's nothing physically wrong with him, yet he will die in about a week, unless I can do something.
You want to have him seized up at the gangway and given 100 lashes, Doctor?
Called the purser from the cabin where he was casting his accounts.
When I was in a Guineaman between the wars, there was a certain sorts of blacks called Wydors or Wydoos that used to die by the dozen in the Middle Passage out of mere despair at being taken away from their country and their friends. We used to save a good many by touching them up with a horsewhip in the mornings. But it'd be no kindness to preserve that chap, Doctor. The people would only smother him or scrag him or shove him overboard in the end. They'll abide a great deal, sailors, but not a Jonah. It's like a white crow. The others peck him to death. Or an albatross. You catch an albatross, it's easy with a line, and paint a red cross on his bosom, and the others will tear him to pieces before the glass is turned. Many's the good laugh we've had with them off the Cape. But the hands will never let that fellow mess with them, not if the commission lasts for 50 years. Ain't that so, Mr. Dillon?
Never, said James.
Why in God's name did he ever come into the Navy? He was a volunteer, not a pressed man.
I conceive he was tired of being a white crow, said Stephen.
But I will not lose a patient because of sailors' prejudices. He must be put to lie out of reach of their malignance. And if he recovers, he shall be my loblolly boy, an isolated employment. So much so, indeed, that the present lad...
I beg your pardon, sir, but Captain's compliments, and would you like to see something amazingly philosophical?
Cried Babington, darting in like a ball.
After the dimness of the gun-room, the white blaze on deck made it almost impossible to see. But through his narrowed eyelids, Stephen could distinguish Old Sponge, the taller Greek, standing naked in a pool of water by the starboard hanses, dripping still, and holding out a piece of copper sheathing with great complacency. On his right stood Jack, his hands behind him, and a look of happy triumph on his face. On his left, most of the watch craning and staring. The Greek held the corroded copper sheet out a little farther, and, watching Stephen's face intently, he turned it slowly over. On the other side there was a small dark fish, with a sucker on the back of its head, clinging fast to the metal.
"A remora!"
cried Stephen with all the amazement and delight the Greek and Jack had counted upon, and more.
"A bucket there!"
"Be gentle with the remora, good Sponge, honest Sponge. Oh, what happiness to see the true remora!"
Old Sponge and young Sponge had been over the side in this flat calm, scraping away the weed that slowed the Sophie's pace. In the clear water they could be seen creeping along ropes, weighed down with nets of shot, holding their breath for 2 minutes at a time, and sometimes diving right under the keel and coming up the other side from lightness of heart. But it was only now that Old Sponge's accustomed eye had detected their sly, common enemy hiding under the garboard strake.
The remora was so strong it had certainly torn the sheathing off, they explained to him. But that was nothing. It was so strong it could hold the sloop motionless, or almost motionless, in a brisk gale. But now they had him. There was an end to his capers now, the dog, and now the Sophie would run along like a swan. For a moment Stephen felt inclined to argue, to appeal to their common sense, to point to the 9-inch fish, to the exiguity of its fins. But he was too wise and too happy to yield to this temptation, and he jealously carried the bucket down to his cabin to commune with the remora in peace. And he was too much of a philosopher to feel much vexation a little later, when a pretty breeze reached them, coming in over the rippling sea just abaft the larboard beam, so that the Sophie, released from the wicked remora, heeled over in a smooth, steady run that carried her along at 7 knots until sunset, when the masthead cried, "Land ho! Land on the starboard bow!" Chapter 7. The land in question was Cape Now, the southern limit of their cruising ground. It stood up there against the western horizon, a dark certainty, hard in the vagueness along the rim of the sky. "A very fine landfall, Mr. Marshall," said Jack, coming down from the top, where he had been scrutinising the cape through his glass. "The Astronomer Royal couldn't have done better." "Thank you, sir, thank you," said the master, who had indeed taken a most painstaking series of lunars, as well as the usual observations, to fix the sloop's position. "Very happy to..." The approbation... His vocabulary failed him, and he finished by jerking his head and clasping his hands by way of expression. It was curious to see this burly fellow, a hard-faced, formidable man, moved by a feeling that called for a gentle, graceful outlet. And more than one of the hands exchanged a knowing glance with a shipmate. But Jack had no notion of this whatsoever. He had always attributed Mr. Marshall's painstaking, scrupulous navigation and his zeal as an executive officer to natural goodness, to his nautical character. And in any case, his mind was now quite taken up with the idea of exercising the guns in the darkness. They were far enough from the land to be unheard with the wind wafting across, and although there had been a great improvement in the Sophie's gunnery, he couldn't rest easy without some daily approach to perfection. "Mr. Dillon," he said, "I could wish the starboard watch to fire against the larboard watch in the darkness." "Yes, I know," he went on, dealing with the objection on his lieutenant's lengthening face, "but if the exercise is carried on from light into darkness, even the poorest crews will not get under their guns or fling themselves over the side. So we will make ready a couple of casks, if you please, for the daylight exercise, and another couple with a lantern or a flambeau or something of that kind for the night." Since the first time he had watched a repetition of the exercise, what a great while since it seemed, Stephen had tended to avoid the performance. He disliked the report of the guns, the smell of the powder, the likelihood of painful injury to the men, and the certainty of a sky emptied of birds. So he spent his time below, reading with half an ear cocked for the sound of an accident. So easy for something to go wrong with a briskly moving gun on a rolling, pitching deck. This evening, however, he came up, ignorant of the approaching din, meaning to go forward to the elm tree pump. The elm tree pump whose head the devoted seaman unshipped for him twice a day, to take advantage of the sloping light as it lit up the underparts of the brig. And Jack said, "Why, there you are, Doctor. You've come on deck to see what progress we've made, no doubt. It's a charming sight, is it not, to see the great guns fire? And tonight you shall see them in the dark, which is even finer. Lord, you should have seen the Nile and heard it.
how happy you would have been.
The improvement in the Sophie's firepower was indeed very striking, even to so unmilitary a spectator as Stephen. Jack had devised a system that was both kind to the sloop's timbers, which really couldn't bear the shock of a united broadside, and good for emulation and regularity. The leeward gun of the broadside fired first, and the moment it was at its full recoil, its neighbour went off. A rolling fire, with the last gun layer still able to see through the smoke. Jack explained all this as the cutter pulled out into the fading light with the casks aboard. "Of course," he added, "we make our run at no great range. Only enough to get in 3 rounds. How I long for 4. The gun crews were stripped to the waist. Their heads were tied up in their black silk handkerchiefs. They looked keenly attentive, at home and competent. There was to be a prize, naturally, for any gun that should hit the mark, but a better one for the watch that should fire the faster without any wild disqualifying shots. The cutter was far away astern and to leeward. It always surprised Stephen to see how smoothly travelling bodies at sea could appear to be almost together at one moment, and then, when one looked round, miles apart without any apparent effort or burst of speed, and the cask was bobbing on the waves. The sloop wore and ran evenly down under her topsails to pass at a cable's length to windward of the cask. "There's little point in being farther," observed Jack, with his watch in one hand and a piece of chalk in the other. "We cannot hit hard enough." The moments passed. The cask bore broader on the bow. "Cast loose your guns!" cried James Dillon. Already the smell of slow match was swirling along the deck. "Level your guns! Out, Tompions! Run out your guns! Prime! Point your guns! Fire!" It was like a great hammer hitting stone at half-second intervals, admirably regular. The smoke streamed racing away in a long roll ahead of the brig. It was the Larbolans who had fired, and the starboard watch, craning their necks a tiptoe upon any point of vantage, watched jealously for the fall of the shot. They pitched too far, 30 yards too far, but they were well grouped. The larboard watch worked with concentrated fury at their guns, swabbing, ramming, heaving in and heaving out. Their backs shone and even ran with sweat. The cask was not quite abeam when the next broadside utterly shattered it. 2:05, said Jack, chuckling. Without even pausing to cheer, the larboard watch raced on. The guns ran up, the great hammer repeated its sevenfold stroke. White water sprang up round the shattered staves. The swabs and rammers flashed. The grunting crews slammed the loaded guns up against their ports, heaving them round with tackles and handspikes as far as ever they would go. But the wreckage was too far behind. They just couldn't get in their 4th broadside. "Never mind," called Jack. "It was very near. 6:10. The larboard watch gave a corporate sigh. They had set their hearts on their 4th broadside and on beating 6 minutes, as they knew very well the starboard watch would do. In fact, the starboard watch achieved 5:57. But, on the other hand, they did not hit their cask. And in the anonymous dusk there was a good deal of audible criticism of unscrupulous grass-combing buggers that blazed away blind and reckless anything to win and powder at 18p the pound. The day had given place to night, and Jack observed with profound satisfaction that it made remarkably little difference on deck. The sloop came up into the wind, filled on the other tack, and bore away towards the wavering flare on the 3rd tub. The broadsides rapped out, one after another, crimson scarlet tongues stabbing into the smoke. The powder boys flitted along the deck, down through the dreadnought screens, past the sentry to the magazine, and back with cartridge. The gun crews heaved and grunted. The matches glowed. The rhythm hardly changed. 6 minutes and 42 seconds, he announced after the last, peering closely at his watch by the lantern. The larboard watch bears the bell away. A not discreditable exercise, Mr. Dillon?
Far better than I had expected, sir, I confess.